This is Edge Cases, the podcast about the grumpier side of software development, mostly, but not always, Apple-related, featuring myself and my co-host, the Bill and Ted of Objective-C. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 55. It's Saturday, July 7th, 2013. And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Software education.
Well, you know, I guess software might need to get, you know, go to school, maybe maybe grade school, maybe high school, right?
I'm probably not college. School. I don't think. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay, that'll be fun. So, but first, we have a little bit of follow up. Yes, Wolf.
Yeah. So you want me, sir?
Sure.
Okay.
Yep. You're the only feedback we got.
Okay. So I'll just do mine. As a shorty here, is a follow up to episode 53, which what was the name? The Poetry of Donald Rumsfeld. Which I guess I like that. Which where we actually talk about.
We did get feedback. Somebody said, "Well, I wish that poetry had been better." Right? Which, you know, fair cop.
Which since the title of the episode has basically no bearing on, has no hints there. That was the episode on software estimation, and so got an email from Art Ford, who he liked the strategy of buying contracting time a week at a time. Said it was simple and elegant, but he had a couple of questions. Number one, how does providing support fit into this? Like customer B buys a dev week at a time, and a wicked bug hits work done for customer A at the beginning of customer B's week at a time. And number two, how long should one provide support? That is, like the code works fine in iOS 3, 2 years later it breaks on iOS 5. So if you ever have more than one contractor, balancing their demands is going to be a problem. It's possible that buying your time week at a time could maybe lead to more interleaving clients. In my experience, that has not been the case. It's been more that you have runs of weeks. And then you might have the odd week here and there, but typically you do buy a week at a time, but it tends to go on for probably as short as 3 weeks, as long as a few months. So that practically has not been a problem.
So no client hyper-threading.
There we go. Yes, the virtual cores and all that. Mm-hmm. And then the other question is, how long should one provide support? For me, support is, especially with his example of, you know, the code that he worked fine on iOS 3 and how it breaks on iOS 5, that, you know, to update it, that's, you know, more time. So that would be scheduling another week. I mean, it's not like I would be building that into the week and saying, oh, if I write the software and this app for you and then for this week, then I'll schedule another week in the future sometime to make sure it works on the latest OS or whatever. No, that's not how it works. It's more, you know, if you want to work on the latest OS, you're going to have to buy another week.
Yeah, I mean, it's related to the whole idea that people get from App Store apps where they say, well, you should be supporting it forever because I paid you $5, you know, 5 years ago. And, you know, I think we've talked and other people have talked about how it's a dangerous thing for Apple to have built into the way the App Store works, because again, as you said, it's not really the way development works. You know, eventually developers will just no longer be able to spend the time on it because they're not getting new money for that support. So
yep. They have to keep paying that mortgage. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the end of my follow up. So the topic, software education. I'm kind of talking about the act of learning how to write software, and. So yeah, it wasn't perhaps the best, you know, entry way to describe the topic, but you always are one to take advantage of the ambiguity. I appreciate that.
I am.
So
I won't. Or am I?
That was really uncalled for. Yeah. So I have a. It filled my MacBook screen, but fortunately, it's smaller on my 27-inch Cinema now that I'm plugged in. So hopefully, this will be a shorter episode. But I've thus cursed us by saying that too. First off, Andrew, I guess I actually don't know what your educational background is in terms of how you got started in this big programming mess thing. So so why don't you tell the listeners at home? How you got started in this?
So I actually don't have a CS degree. I have a English degree, actually. And so I came into development. Well, that sounds wrong. I came into programming later on. And it was during the first dot-com boom. And it's funny because I was just listening to the Bitsplitting podcast with Buzz Anderson, where he talked about his background. And it was something similar. You know, it was a good time to break into the field because they kind of needed every warm body they could find. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you get different approaches at different companies. Some companies and some hiring managers, et cetera, will look at you if you have learned stuff on your own outside of a formal educational background and say, wow, this person has, initiative. This person has the ability to, you know, do things outside of the box. And other places will say, well, if you don't have the formal education, we don't want you. Although the latter does tend to happen more where they want higher degrees of education. You know, hey, if you don't have an MS or a PhD, then we don't want you. I think Google, some parts of Google are like that.
And, it's my understanding it has gotten a lot more loosened up in the last few years.
I think so. Well, and it's... Yeah, well, there certainly are going to be engineers you want to have who have practice in certain ways of thinking that you don't normally have. But I have, I've seen a lot of engineers, obviously done a lot of engineering work myself, and the times when you need, for example, all that stuff that they throw at you during interviews, right? It's just... It's vanishingly small that you need. So what you really need is just to have learned, certain of the basics and then the APIs, and that gets you through the day most places. And also that initiative really gets you places because if you're willing, the APIs change so often. You mm-hmm. get new stuff coming from Apple so often that even if you did have a really great education, the further back in time it was, the less you can rely on it. So that wasn't quite what you asked, but yeah. So my background is self-taught, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's we have a similar background then, so that's interesting.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'll kind of go over as I go through my outline here. But so I kind of narrowed it down to two basic routes that I see most people learning how to write software. And that would be the pragmatic and or immediate. This is pretty much what I believe you and I did. When you do the autodidact thing, it's not necessarily that you will focus on the pragmatic, but I think it just tends to fall that way because the books you read tend to be like, build this app and here are the APIs and so forth. So I think it tends to be more pragmatic. And then, of course, on the flip side is the academic. So if the pragmatic is kind of a top-down where you're like, you want to build this app and you fill in, you color, you know, you build, do the broad strokes and you fill in all the details, the academic is more kind of, why do we have circles in the first place that you want to color? And that would be kind of more the MITs and Stanfords and where you do the bottom-up type stuff.
Sure.
I would say the pragmatics also, you will be found in the vocational schools, if you want to use a derogatory term for that, Java schools seems to be the way to refer to them. And in our industry, like vocational schools, I don't know, tend to be kind of more prevalent in air conditioner repair or maybe plumbing. And for programming, I know there are programming courses out there, but I don't know. It's like most of the people in my bubble that have actually gone to the so-called vocational schools, it really wasn't a vocational school per se. It's more that they went to like Big Nerd Ranch or they went to, I know in Chicago there's like Mobile Makers, I think, which is like a three-month thing. There's a few of these where it's like it's more of a, that's all they teach, and it tends to be kind of, instead of like this kind of a university-ish thing that teaches multiple technical disciplines, they focus on software for maybe even a specific platform. And so that's kind of our version, apparently, of these vocational schools. At least that, I'm at least in my bubble, that seems to be the most popular. So with me, I actually have no degrees. So I like to joke that I have a grade school education, because that was the last year of schooling I actually finished, because I didn't finish junior high, and I did homeschooling for 2 years, I think, and then I started college early, but I didn't finish college, so I have a grade school education. And so essentially, I was a kid with a computer and a compiler, and I had a local library that had a bunch of computer books, and I had ambition, and I had no clients, so I had lots of time. And I think for the ambition part is where I kind of got the top-down thing where I wanted to build these apps. I had grand ambitions about the type of apps I could build. I was obviously wild with the Mac and Mac software, and I wanted to achieve that level of software. So I kind of had the top-down thing going on. But on the other hand, I had no real deadlines, no real time frames, and everything was new to me. And I had a freaking library that I would go to like every other day, I would say. And I would pretty much read all their computer science books. And anything that had to do with programming, check out and read. And then, of course, then there was local Barnes & Nobles, and then I would buy the books that the library didn't have. And this ended up, because I think I didn't have, like, client deadlines or anything like that, I kind of overshot, and I read a lot of backgrounder stuff that I probably didn't need to in order to get my work done. And, of course, I finished very few apps, but I learned a lot doing it. And even books like, did you ever read Computer Lib / Dream Machines?
No, I did not.
Okay, that was, I just saw a PDF go by that. In fact, let me put in my notes here so I remember to send a link for that, Dream Machines. But that was like a very hippie-ish kind of programming book, and the idea of what computers are versus what they could be, and it was very eye-opening to me. And so that was pretty much my background. I did end up taking some computer science courses when I was going to my liberal arts college, but they were pretty much made up kind of by the professor and myself on the fly, what we would teach, because he and I were pretty much the only ones who had programming experience. And I think I had more practical programming experience than he did, which is a topic I'll come back to. So we kind of helped make up the curriculum. He had a kind of a more the academic background, which actually was pretty helpful. So we talked about how like the Java schools is probably the standard derogatory term to refer to the vocational schools. So I didn't really do that. I like you was autodidact and was self-taught in all this. And through the grace of being a young kid when I was doing it, I think I end up filling in a lot more of the kind of the academic, non-practical side of things than I would have if I were to jump right into the industry. I think that helped a lot. So I have a really healthy respect for the academic side of things. And so if I'm going to talk about, use the derogatory term Java schools to refer to the pragmatic side of learning how to program, then I think probably the academic side I'm going to refer to as scheme schools. So kind of highlight the kind of the non-practicality of that. And which is, when I was looking this up, it doesn't quite fit, because apparently I knew this before, but I had to remind myself that MIT now uses Python instead of Scheme in its undergraduate CS program, which caused quite the consternation amongst the LispEds. And I'll include a link there. It was actually very interesting. The basic thrust of why is that Sussman believes that programming has basically changed since they decided on using Scheme way back when. That he was basically echoing your point of earlier, that programming has become more about learning how things work and gluing them together than starting from scratch and writing things from the ground up. And Scheme doesn't have the libraries, and Python does. And they specifically chose Python because it already had this cool little robot programming library or something that they could start using. So they actually didn't really care what language would use. They just but that one was already had the library they wanted to use. And so in the grand scheme of using what's available in front of you, I guess I overloaded the word scheme there, but they chose Python.
Well, just as a brief aside here, mm-hmm. I did learn Scheme even though I didn't learn it in school. And the place where I learned it, to connect us back to an earlier episode, was actually an interactive fiction game written by Andrew Plotkin, who's kind of a big deal in the interactive fiction world. He actually wound up writing in, you know, the world environment that you use to write these games. He wrote something that was a Scheme tutorial.
Mm.
So, pretty weird, but it worked. It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, Scheme is keeps on, like, the last place I saw Scheme kind of pop up is, I believe, in, like, Apple sandboxing. Policies are, like, actually in a Scheme language or something.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit weird. I think Jalcut had a link to that, or at least mentioned it in a blog post. Also put that down, see if I can dig that up and put it in the show notes.
Cool.
And so, as an aside, I did a little bit digging, so it turned out to be pretty hard to Google this, but I don't know. There's this kind of this jokey thing, the idea that any field that has the word science in its name probably isn't. And so you can tell that computer science isn't real science because we put just the word science in its name. So you can think of, like, political science and social science and all these other science things, right? And it's really...
Wow, how many people can we piss off?
Well, it's and then unfortunately you dig a little bit deeper and you realize, oh, there's actually a bunch of legitimate sciences that actually have the word science in their name. So it's like, but it is fun, the idea of such a thing. And so computer science in general kind of suffers from what is known as physics envy, which is, you know, that physics is just amazingly predictable and reproducible, and you can validate things and invalidate things, and it works so well. It's so many other sciences that as soon as you get anywhere away from physics, it seems like nothing really measures up. And obviously, computer science kind of falls in the same way. But I would actually say, I mean, there's a big division here between computer science and computer engineering, and I think that's a large,
right.
Mm-hmm. Big part of the difference between the pragmatic and the academic, how it's approached. And so I think a lot of this is that it depends on really what you're talking about. When I just talk about software, obviously software is comprised of both things, the pragmatic and the academic, and the computer engineering and the computer science side of things. And it's easy to kind of muddle them together and they'll say, oh, it's a software, and you end up kind of getting pissed off and talking about, you know, why isn't it this way? Well, because there are all these two sides of the same coin. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of the pros and cons of the academic way of approaching software education and the pragmatic way of doing it. So there's this standard kind of put down, this disparaging word of academic. Like, you can say, oh, that problem is academic, and it's really meant to kind of disparage that. Oh, that. What you're asking about is the phrase I like to use here is the distinction without a difference. The kind of like it's how many angels are dancing on the head of a pin type stuff. It's like, yes, you can spend all day talking about this stuff, but effectively it doesn't matter. And that's unfair to academia and academic pursuit in general. But there's, like, so many things, there's a kernel of truth in there that I don't want to gloss over and say, oh, no, that doesn't fit at all. So I think the important thing about the academic way of pursuing this stuff is that it gives you, especially for people who you and me, who kind of started on the pragmatic side of things, is that it provides a downshift to address a bigger picture. What was that? I just realized that there's, like, that Steve Jobs quote, like, it's like liberal arts meets computer science or something. Is that how they framed software at Apple. This popped in my head now. But.
The intersection of computer science and liberal arts. I believe that's the quote.
Okay. Yes. I don't really know what that means, but it's interesting. I'll see if I can't make up my mind what that means before the end of the episode. And I think part of the disparity thing about the academia type stuff, and is by saying a problem is academic, is that you say that it's not relevant to what needs to be done. It's not relevant to the problem at hand. It's not relevant to the real world. And I just kind of went through a list of things that kind of popped in my head when I realized that, you know, these academic things, kind of that seem almost theoretical in nature, they're actually highly relevant. And I just have a few here I want to talk about. The one that really kind of, that's in Apple technologies. And when you look at Core Animation, has some interesting kind of very academic-y type things in it. For example, the 3D transformations using matrix multiplication, that geometry type stuff. And you could say that geometry is kind of this kind of mathy in general, and definitely kind of more on the academic side of things. But it goes to show how this is actually highly relevant to the software you use every day. The idea of, you know, the 3D coordinate systems and using transformations to manipulate those as you display them very effectively. So that's a good example of kind of like the academic underpinnings kind of forming the foundation for something that's very highly practical. Core Animation, and its goal-directed animation system, where you have a rectangle in the upper left-hand corner, you want to move to the bottom right-hand corner, and along the way, the user taps on something, and you decide it needs to be in the upper right-hand corner. And so instead of doing a straight line, it kind of does this curve thing, because now it's like it was in flight, but now it has to move to a different location. I mean, that type of that's this kind of like simple interpolation, but it's still in that type of stuff where you're animating over frame over a series of time, and you're trying to figure out where you need to go based on where you've been and where their goals are changing. I mean, that's also academic. And there are algorithms behind that. And, of course, also our recent friend, Auto Layout, with his constraint solver.
Friend or possibly, you know.
Well, we can call Auto Layout a frenemy. How about that?
Oh! I was just going to say enemy.
Oh, okay.
But, okay, we'll split the difference.
Yeah. And so, of course, Auto Layout's constraint solver is a good example of this pretty kind of intellectual, academic-type thing kind of shining through and being highly practical. And one thing that bit me about 12, well, I guess probably more than that. Yeah. But anyway, a bunch of years ago is that I was writing an e-commerce website. And one of the things was that it was already deployed and all that, and I was working on optimizing the shipping rates, because the shipping was pretty expensive for the merchandise. And like, oh, maybe I know that we use like 5 standard box sizes and we have these products, and maybe I'll just write this program that will do a better job of figuring out how to coalesce these boxes together so that we can figure out the minimum possible box that we can send out and save a bunch of shipping. Because I believe it's not just by weight, but it's also the size of the box. And some boxes were much more expensive than others. And as I was writing this code, I think it took me a few hours to realize this reminds me of something, and this seems to be really hard. And I realized it was a variant of the knapsack problem, which is well known in cryptography circles. And it was only because I had read, you know, the computability problems and the P equals net NP problems that I realized I was able to recognize it. So that was a good example of this. For me, kind of knowing the literature and kind of even the high level things, that I was able to recognize, oh, this is actually a really hard problem to solve. That maybe I just should give up on this. So that's a good thing, is that knowledge helps you give up earlier.
Well, don't all computer science problems eventually boil down to sorting?
Well, I actually had not considered that.
Well, I mean, it's one way to, I mean, it's a joke, but also it's a way to say organizing your data in the right way is is in the end, you know, kind of all that really matters at the lower level.
Interesting. That's really interesting. A couple more is that
just blew your mind.
Exactly. It's like that anime GIF of the guy who's was. I want to say it was a Carl Sagan thing, but I don't think so. I think it's from the BBC or something. But anyway, I'll try to find a link to the explosion GIF. Apparently now,
very important.
Yes, yeah, very important. The couple more here is that I was working on a file system accelerator cache thing, and it turns out that the insertions were happening not very often, and it wasn't time critical when they happened, but retrieval is very time critical. And fortunately, I knew about the perfect hash data structure that allows you to, when you crane your hash, you can basically notice when your buckets are going to overflow, and you can rejigger the hashes on everything. And what's great about that is that you guarantee constant time access. And so that is because of kind of my research into data structures, which is definitely more of an academic type thing. I knew about this data structure that fit very well into what we wanted to use there. And finally, in terms of I had, this is really fun because this is it's like infinite compressibility is kind of like the perpetual motion of I guess the software world. And yes, and I've done both. I've designed both a perpetual motion machine before I knew there was such things and why you can't do it. And I also tried to create an infinite compression system, which I didn't realize there was infinite compression until I had the insight. And then it took me a couple beats more to kind of realize why it couldn't work. But my scheme was, which I think is pretty clever, is that at the time I was quite impressed by cyclical redundancy checksums, the CRCs, that are used to protect data when they go over the wire. So like all like TCP packets, IP, IP packets in general, have a CRC. They tend to be like 16-bit CRCs, a lot weaker. But the idea is that you can kind of think of a CRC as a hash or a bit blender, where you mix up bits in a certain way. And then it's if any single bit gets flipped, it's pretty easy to rerun that math and notice that something's gone wrong. So you can discard that.
I'm not sure I've heard the term bit blender before.
That's
for a hash.
Yeah. I think it's a pretty effective little way to describe that. Yeah. And so my genius take on this was that so you take this take a megabyte file and you put a 16-bit CRC or 32-bit CRC on it, and the idea then is that you could throw away basically n plus 1 bits of the file, and then you could try to regenerate it basically trading computation time, and where you know the file is invalid, but you could then try to supply the missing bits randomly and keep on running the algorithm until your CRC passed. So, right. And I mean, in theory, you wouldn't have to be like just throwing away random bits. You just could throw away so if you have say 16-bit CRC, you just throw away the first 17 bits, right? So you know you need to come up with the first 17 bits to make sure it works. And of course, your compression algorithm really compression rate really sucks, and you're only getting 1 bit per megabyte or whatever. But the important thing is that you could rerun this again and again, right? So you could it would be very computationally intensive to do all this, but it'd be infinite because you just could keep on throwing out each round. You could throw away 1 more bit.
Oh, wolf.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of myself until I realized it. It was really a 1-2 punch because it was when I realized that you could run this again and again forever, and then I realized this sounds like I'm violating information theory.
Yeah.
So so that was a good kind of a wake up call to that I wasn't nearly as clever as I thought, and I didn't even get around to trying to write an implementation of it because it was obvious to me. Thanks to the academic background, that this thing that seemed pragmatic was just really bullshit. So that's kind of the academic pros. So academia is actually really effective, and it's very powerful, and it's really something you want to have in your back pocket. However, academia also, it really strikes me as mostly wasted human potential. With the there's most of the material that's being studied in academia is for like personal self-growth, and I see a lot of it never actually being applied to shipping software. I have a lot of friends in academia, and I also see a lot of their I feel like a lot of their work doesn't actually make it to shipping software.
And, you mean like professors or students or
both?
Both, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I think we're kind of like we are entering, if we haven't already entered, the post-opulent world where it's actually good for people to waste their time. That we kind of have more people than we need to actually produce things now, so we need to come up with more and more clever ways for people to waste their time. So it seems like we're productive because we kind of have a value system that's based on productivity, even though people don't need to be productive anymore.
Well, isn't that Facebook?
Pretty much, yes. And so we must maintain the illusion of productivity, or just for our old value system to keep on hanging the way it is hanging. And so it's wasting time is crucial in a post-opulent society. So that actually probably fits in well if people spend you know 8 years of their life doing graduate program software engineering, software research or whatever, without actually for self-edification and not actually shipping anything. It strikes me I'm getting used to this idea. I'm still getting used to this idea, but that said, obviously. Academia does come up with some really, this is almost like the only wellspring of human advancement we have. So, of course, there's tons of wasted human potential there. But it seems like, don't get me wrong, there's definitely advancements that come from the industry as well. But a certain class of human advancement only comes from academia. And obviously, it almost doesn't matter how much waste is produced from that, just so long as we get some advancements out of there. And it's almost asking for too much to be like highly efficient and advanced. I think I mentioned the Tom DeMarco book Slack before on this podcast. If I haven't, do you remember if I mentioned that?
I don't remember. You may have.
Okay, so I'll put it in the show notes as well. Slack is a short read by Tom DeMarco, author of Peopleware, a great book, where he basically argues that you can't be efficient and creative simultaneously. And the idea is that when companies say that they're lean and mean and they try to cut to the bone, is that actually they're reducing by reducing slack, they reduce the abilities, the organization's ability to deal with new circumstances and to analyze and come and understand what challenges are over the horizon and kind of address those proactively. If I can't believe I use the word proactive, but sometimes it actually fits. Anyway, so the other thing is that academia tends to be almost aggressively anti-pragmatic or anti-industry. So Victoria, my girlfriend Victoria Wang, she came to programming. I guess she actually started programming more of a self-taught type thing, and kind of then she actually worked at contracting, and then she did a computer science degree. And famously, her professor, well, famous among us, I guess, is that her professor never used version control. And version control is one of the staples of the pragmatic, of the industry, and to have not used version control strikes me as something that's not real world at all. I mean, this is something that's kind of fundamental. And he was the lead guy there. And this is, you see this a lot. You see, the type of things that that's this very common industry that you kind of need to be able to ship software. like even the skeletal structure is missing from academia. And I think this is kind of contributes to kind of the waste of human potential in academia, that that they often focus on what's not important to actually shipping software, and instead kind of waste time on things that aren't that important. But like I said, you know, it does lead to a different type of progress. So, I mean, that's kind of unavoidable, perhaps.
When it strikes me as much that this is a cultural divide in as much as it's a technical divide.
Mm. Okay, that's a really good point. I hadn't considered that way. Yeah, definitely. So lest you think, I mean, in my outline here, I was kind of have academic pros and academic cons, and I decided not to cover pragmatic pros because it's society's pragmatic, and I think our culture kind of just assumes that something when something is pragmatic that that's a good thing. That, and so I don't think I even need to shipping software. It's obviously, and at the end of the day, it's almost that's what it's all about. And so,
well, by skipping the pros, you're actually being more pragmatic.
There you go. So I'll just talk about the cons, which I see too, at least. Kent Beck, who you should follow on Twitter. Oh, and I'll put a note to myself to link to Kent Beck as well. He had linked to a David Parnas, I guess it's a very short interview, and he has this gem of a phrase here. He says, "One bad programmer can easily create 2 new jobs a year." And I think that's actually very powerful, and it's true that you can actually – a unskilled software professional, quote-unquote professional, is more destructive than creative, more than constructive, that it will cause more damage because even if that programmer potentially can ship the software, that the man hours, for each man hour he puts in to ship that software, he might be racking up 2 man hours that will be needed for that software maintenance.
Yeah, multiples.
Yes.
I would even say 2 is actually probably kind of low.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
From my experience.
But, that's I'm sure other fields. I mean, I could be a probably really bad plumber and probably create messes of things and make it actually harder for future plumbers. But I don't know. It just seems like...
like an architect. They mm-hmm. make a building, which is a bad building, and suddenly you need all sorts of contractors to maintain it because it's not built very well. No, I think that can happen in other fields.
Yes, but it's different people in different field, right? It's not like he's causing more work for fellow architects,
I suppose. But is that distinction academic?
Touche. So for the people like you and me who kind of like started from the pragmatic side, I'm really worried about kind of the people who, pick up back in our day, it was, learn C++ in 21 days, right? And these type of books that, just enough so that you can start doing kind of the bare minimum where you can ship software. But underneath that veneer of productivity, that veneer of actually getting software out the door, you're actually causing more damage than what you're actually creating. I think that's probably my biggest concern with kind of focusing on the pragmatic side of the route to software education is this, that one bad programmer can easily create 2 new jobs a year.
We've got pretty high unemployment right now. I don't see the problem.
Hey, right? And we can create a new tree. This could be our new multi-level marketing scam that everyone can become a bad programmer. Yeah, I like this. I like this a lot. And the second con to kind of the pragmatic route is that a lot of how I would say that the pragmatic people get started is that the intern they start working at a corporation right away, and man, corporations are not usually shining examples of software best practices.
Some corporation, sure, big. So
you have that knowing laugh because I tell, and because of the extent of the programming, of the contract I've done, at many different corporations, that every corporation is broken in a unique and interesting way. And so every corporation seems to be very. It's amazing when you know when you see what's you know when you see how the sausage is being made. You're like, wow! So this is how you actually either they don't have processes or you can't believe the processes. But the idea is that if you don't have kind of like the again, this is I guess even at maybe academia doesn't help you here, but it's almost like you need to be at this point. You need to be kind of like do the research yourself and kind of know the idealized, because academia does not seem to provide. At least not often, does not, I would say actually in the common case, does not provide kind of software best practices. And they tend to be more about the ideas. And corporations also tend not to be about software best practices. They tend about getting, you know, the bits out there.
Where can you turn? Who will save us?
I guess we have to rely on ourselves, and this is why we create this podcast, right? Our shiny example.
Well, no, you know, I was thinking as you were saying that yeah, what you need is someone. You need the grizzled, you know, veterans to give you those lessons.
Yeah, pretty much. And I don't know if you've witnessed this or felt this, but about the kind of the age discrimination of our industry, is that I personally have not, and I've had gray hair for a while, but I also speak really, really quickly and kind of use California slang. So I think that probably
it's your way of appearing young.
Right. I mean, there's a kind of a general disrespect in our industry for what's come before, kind of, you know, the new shiny is obviously what's better, but I don't know.
No, I think I've seen that there's, I mean, the reason you want younger engineers is when you want to exploit them, you know. I mean, when you want to make them work, you know, tons of hours and weekends and whatever, and you know they won't complain. But one thing that I believe I've seen in the industry that I've seen is an understanding that you need that they can't be all you have to get stuff out the door,
right?
So it's funny. I mean, I would have thought I would have seen more of it, but I actually, I don't know. I guess I haven't.
It might be something that's kind of time delayed for us too, because when you and I got started, again, it sounded like you actually came in during a boom, but then a lot of people got washed away in the bust. But you know, when I got started, it was there's a lot less people in the software industry in general, and obviously that's inflating with each year as software eats the world. And I probably should also link to that article, Software Eats the World.
Title.
There you go. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't become a much bigger issue, say, 20, 30 years from now, and where you're going to have a lot more grizzled veterans vying, jockeying for the same position.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm curious how this – we are definitely in a boom, but – I don't see, but since we're inside it, it's hard to see what the contours of it exactly are. Mm-hmm. That there is going to be another bust is seems to me pretty certain,
right?
But I don't know when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So since you were brought on during the .com boom, so how did you survive the bust?
I found a port in the storm. I was actually pretty lucky. I did find a company that that had work for me. Mm-hmm. And I basically survived that pretty much up until Apple. And it's funny, even at Apple, and I talked about Buzz beforehand. Should mm-hmm. I tell you this story? It's actually not even much of a story. But I was actually talking to him when I joined Apple, and he gave me sort of the scoop on what Apple was like mm-hmm. back then. And he said that they were still doing layoffs. Like right up until I got hired, basically.
Wow.
And you know, whether it was me, it probably wasn't just me, but really that meteoric rise that Apple had kind of took place, again, can't take sole credit, pretty much around when I was there. When did the iPod come out? I know. Sorry, people. Didn't really mean that.
I like about the glorification of grizzled veterans in this episode and... You are responsible for Apple's meteoric rise.
I'm the one. But yeah, so even Apple, you know, Apple was obviously having some really large difficulties before Steve Jobs came back. And it is interesting because I think Apple has been part of the boom as far as software engineers are concerned. Mm-hmm. But I also think that Apple stands apart from that. So, you know, I really, again, I can't tell you the exact contours of it because it's hard to see exactly. But I think, you know, the punch of the second boom, part of that is that Apple has, it's more than one boom kind of going on at the same time. I think it's both web and Apple and native stuff. And so, you know, Apple's rise could have happened, you know, before the other boom, but it looks like they pretty much coincided. Mm-hmm. And that makes it really, again, you know, people coming up today, they might just think, well, it's never going to go bad. This is just the way it's going to be from now on. And, you know, the graybeards are going to tell you that it's not. That's not what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And also, just I guess to follow up on that, mm-hmm. you had talked about, what was that, a post-abundance?
I was calling it the post-opulent society.
Post-opulent society. My take on that is that, again, anyone who thinks that growth will last forever, mm-hmm. it's almost certainly going to have another thing coming to them.
Oh, sure.
There's always limits to growth. And in fact, I even had a podcast about that, you know, however long ago. I don't know when the growth is going to stop, but I think it is. And I think the better you're prepared for it, you know, the better off you'll be.
Are you a hoarder?
Well, hoarding might not be the right way to go about it. I mean, you know, holding on to things that you've bought during a time of plenty may not be what you need to get through a time of scarcity.
Oh, why?
Wow, we're going pretty much off the rails here. But but in terms of maybe to bring that back, I mean, it's like, what will happen? Like the two different times of things that you're talking about, academic versus practical, like which of those will be better for you to have that background mm-hmm. when things go bad again. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that flexibility is going to be a big part of it. And whichever system will give you that flexibility, whichever part of those systems will give you flexibility, is probably what you want to hold on to.
Yeah, it strikes me as basically a hybrid of the two then. Yeah. I would actually wait on the pragmatic. But
what do you mean wait on the pragmatic?
I would say that if you could
wait it towards.
Yeah, yes. If you could design, and it's, obviously this is academic, but distinction without a difference. But if you could simplify it as much as a mixed ratio, I would say maybe 80 to 90% pragmatic with 10 to 20% academic. And that seems to be, you know, you ship software, and yet you don't tend to miss the big obvious things, and you miss a bit, but yeah.
Well, in terms of finding an advantage for yourself, I think that having a certain amount of academic background or a certain amount of that theoretical knowledge is definitely going to help you stand out
right.
when you need to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of I have a friend who, well, at least back then, worked on the iPod file system. And he was also doing interviews for job candidates who work on the iPod OS. Uh-huh. And it was they were able to call the field very rapidly just by, you know, getting people who actually understood pointers.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What helps to be a little smarter than stupid, I suppose?
The Java schools people, yes. Yeah. Mm. Okay, so I just have a short list here of kind of wrapping up and kind of addressing this at a higher level and kind of what I want. And so so that mixed ratio of kind of the ideal, I was kind of part of it. But first priority for me is engineers who ship apps. So I want the people in our field to be able to ship their apps. And I don't just mean the version 1.0 or the first version you start working on. I also mean multiple versions of the apps. Because I mentioned how one of the cons on the pragmatic side is that one bad programmer can actually, you know, in the name of shipping one version, can actually derail future versions. So I'm talking about the long term here, be able to ship multiple versions of the same app and multiple apps. So that's kind of priority one for me, which is why I tend to follow finally kind of fall on more on the pragmatic side. And number two is that I want engineers who know about software architecture and understand the various trade-offs of software architecture. This kind of feeds into the idea that one bad programmer can do so much damage by doing bad things badly that are expedient. And which is interesting because I wrote this, even though it's my number two, I thought of it after I came up with my number three, which the number three is very important to me, but I think the number two there with knowing about software architecture and actually knowing how to write, how to leverage the various design patterns and the common practices effectively is second to actually shipping. And you could even say that number two actually feeds into number one, that in order to ship multiple versions of the apps, you need to know how to architect correctly. So you could almost argue that number two is a subset of number one. But my third one, which I thought was number two, but now is number three, is engineers that understand how things work. And kind of the phrase that's being tossed around in the industry is the full stack engineer. Although it's funny because the full stack engineer is, you know, it's like where does the stack end? It's like, you know, if you know Ruby,
where the syrup starts.
Oh wow! Okay, good. If you know Ruby, is that good enough? If you know C, is that good enough? If you know assembly, is that good enough? I mean, ideally for me, it's from transistors up that you know about gates, and you could, you know, use that to build a microprocessor. And I'm not saying that you should actually know about all the current like cache technology and how transistors are effectively used, and maybe even lithographic process, but at least the logical theoretical background that you could build from the transistors up. But again, you know, as soon as you define the bottom of anything, it's like, well, is that really deep enough? Shouldn't you know at the quantum level how this stuff is working, and why when you dope silicon do you get transistors in the first place? Can you explain that? And so obviously this turtles all the way down, but I think probably from transistors up, from a logical standpoint, and if you can understand assembly on up, I think that's way deep enough, and it's actually I think it's way beyond actually what most of the, probably what 98% of the industry even wants or calls for. So you're definitely ahead of the game there if you have that type of foundation. So yeah, so those three things. And I want both these paths, the pragmatic and the academic, to lead to engineers who know how to ship apps, how to architect apps correctly, and understand how things work at a pretty low level, but not all the way to the quarks. So yeah, so that's pretty much what my ideal is, and I think that the current academic system is not addressing it well, and a pure play kind of a pragmatic approach, even with the kind of the vocational schools that we have today, also doesn't lead to that. So the best way I know to that is kind of you start on the pragmatic side and you kind of build your way down from there, like sounds like pretty much you and I did.
Funny thing that.
Yeah, the grizzled veterans know what we're talking about.
So if you have those skills, Wolf is hiring, so you know, you should contact him on Twitter. Okay, so is that about wrap
that,
it up?
That does it for me.
Okay. Alrighty, so please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes, and more, and we'll see you next time.